I'd like to invite you to turn to Hebrews chapter 10 this morning. Hebrews chapter 10, please. Hopefully over the last few weeks we've been able to establish, I think, as a biblical truth, that spiritual discouragement is to be expected in a sin-cursed world as we, who are sinners, live out and even seek to follow Christ in it. And God knows that, and therefore moves toward us to minister to us in that regard. Last week we saw that the God of hope can fill us with all joy and peace as we trust in Christ, and that can cause us to abound in hope by the power of the Spirit. 2 weeks ago, though, we looked at the passage in 2 Corinthians 7 where Paul said, But God, who comforts the depressed or the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And in that text, I talked about it as the need for spiritual comfort. The source of spiritual comfort was God. But then the instrument of spiritual comfort was actually Titus, that God used Titus to be the source of comfort or refreshment for Paul. And so what we want to do and recognize in saying that source-instrument combination is that we're never looking to humans to do only what God can do. I mean, God is the source of it. So if we put too much hope in what a person can do, then we're going to be disappointed because no human can actually accomplish the task of filling us with all joy and peace in believing and cause us to abound in hope by the power of the Spirit. Only God can do that. So we have to make certain we keep these clear, or else we'll turn our attention to humans and we will have a short-term and shallow comfort. The minute the instrument's gone, then the comfort will be depleted. So we have to be ultimately looking to God and trusting Him, resting in Him to do it, relying on it. But if we don't recognize this combination of source and instrument, then sometimes what we can do is actually dislocate ourselves from the place and the way in which God will bring us spiritual comfort. I mean, that most often, God uses human instruments to comfort His suffering people. And I say most often because God's God, and He can bypass that human instrumentality, assuming that we're looking to Him, right? And looking to Him through His Word. So it is possible that we might be deeply discouraged and we turn to the Word and God greatly refreshes us apart from anybody speaking the Word to us or bringing encouragement to us. God certainly can do that, and many of us have experienced that. But sometimes when we're in the depth of discouragement, it's precisely some help that we need to help lift us out of it. And that's what Paul, I think, was referring to. So, Lord willing, what I'd like to do this morning and next Sunday is actually talk about that human instrument side of it and think about how we can be instruments used by God to be a source of spiritual encouragement and refreshment. All right, so we're going to start in Hebrews chapter 10 and look at what is, I think, probably a familiar passage, but I hope we'll look at it through the eyes and from the perspective that I was just trying to lay out for us. Just so we can get the start of the sentence, start in verse 23 of chapter 10. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for He who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate or provoke one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. So you can see the phrase in verse 10 or 25 that says, encouraging one another. So that's why we're at this text. But look at in verse 24 at the command that comes. Let us consider one another. And in between that is how to provoke. All right, so let's consider how to provoke or stimulate one another to love and good deeds. Not forsaking, but encouraging. So if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I used four words, and we're going to, Lord willing, unpack those four words, two of them this morning, two next week. The first word was, we must see. We must see the need. If we're going to be an instrument used by God to bring encouragement to those who need it, we have to see the need for it. And that verse 24 says, let us consider one another. Let us set our attention, think carefully about, thoughtfully about. In fact, this is the same word that's used in Acts chapter 11, where Peter has his vision of the sheet that comes down with the clean and unclean animals. And there it, Peter says, I had fixed my gaze on it. I mean, that's the kind of word that he's using here when he says, let us consider something. Fix your attention on it. Lock in on this issue and try to understand it. So the text is calling us to serious spiritual observation of one another in order to develop some perception about the needs of people. The reason I say the needs of people is because he's talking about here in both 24 and 25 what would be spiritual realities in their life, right? That you're to be helpful about. You're to help provoke or stimulate them to love and good deeds. So the idea here, in fact, this word translated stimulate is not used usually in a positive way. In fact, the one other exact use of the term is a command not to do this toward each other in Galatians chapter 5. Stop provoking one another. I mean, clearly in the context, it's a negative context, but it's the kind of provoking that can happen when people are in each other's faces, and it says, stop doing that. It is used about Paul, related from the word family, is used of Paul in Acts chapter 17 when he's in Athens, and if you're familiar with that passage, he's there on a little break, he's resting, but it says he sees the city wholly given to idolatry, and his spirit was provoked within him. As when he saw that all of the city was worshiping idols instead of the true and living God, his spirit was provoked. It was stirred up in him so that he felt compelled that he had to speak. And so he began to preach in the marketplace and the synagogue. So it's the kind of thing that you know, something happens that sort of pokes you into action. And that's what this text is saying. We're supposed to be looking at one another to sort of poke each other toward love and good works, to prod each other, to encourage, to stimulate, to provoke one another in that way. So we're supposed to be attentive, and that attention is for the purpose of help, not criticism. Right? So I mean, this is the thing that sometimes gets us a little nervous. It's like, you know, I shouldn't be a spiritual snoop looking at everybody else's problems. And I'd say, yeah, the point isn't that you're trying to be a problem detector. You're trying to be a help giver. You're trying to see where a brother or sister might need encouragement, verse 25. All right? They might need someone to come alongside of them and help prod them toward love and good work. To move them in that direction. So we're supposed to be attentive and helpful, not critical, and it's supposed to be of a spiritual nature. But that can't happen without some level of proximity, right? That's why verse 25 says, not forsaking our own assembling together. I mean, so here's the kind, and you probably know the background of Hebrews, that these people had professed faith in Christ, they were facing persecution. It was costing them something to follow Christ. We'll see a little bit more about that in a moment. So they were under pressure, and specifically that pressure was not necessarily alleviated by gathering with the assembly. It actually could be intensified because they were being open about the fact that they were followers of Jesus. And so there were some, it says the habit of some is, who were abandoning the assembly. They were basically starting to pull away from it so that they could avoid the problems. Okay, and so the writer of Hebrews is saying, listen, that's not the route to go. Okay, you're going into trouble, you've got problems, you've got issues that are confronting you. The answer isn't to forsake the assembly. It actually is to be engaged and committed to, so that you can be seeing the needs around you, moving to encourage and help and provoke love and good works in that regard. I mean, this kind of observation demands close proximity. The fellowship of God's people is supposed to create the context of care. All right? It's, you know, lots of times people will talk about, I mean, they'll use imageries, and so sometimes they'll say the church is like a hospital. And in some senses that's true, but it's not supposed to be just like an emergency room. Right? And I think sometimes the way we end up treating it is like, everything's cool till it's really not. And then we've got to kick into massive work. Instead of it actually being a context within which there's this kind of mutual care going on, because members are seeing needs and moving to provoke to love and good works and moving to encourage one another. So that there is actually that ongoing work. We must have our eyes open. We do have to answer the question that plagues all of us because of our selfishness. Am I my brother's keeper? With a yes. We are responsible for each other. We are responsible to help each other. We are responsible to see the needs around us. So how can you improve your vision? Okay, I mean, how can, you know, so I got to tell you, you need to have your eyes open, you need to see. So how can we improve in there? Let me suggest three things for us to consider. The first would be this, is that we should connect the dots between circumstances and cares in this world. Right? And here's what I mean by that. 2 Corinthians 1:4 says that we are to comfort with the comfort that we receive. Right? So here's a simple way for us to think about this. What circumstances in my life have tended to weigh heavy on me, discourage me, cause me challenges, then it's probably a pretty safe conclusion to say that people going through those same things will have those same needs. Right? I mean, we're supposed to comfort people with the comfort we've received. So where did we need comfort? I mean, you've had a life of experience of living in a fallen world, and you know the bumps and the aches and the difficulties with that. So that has been God's providential way of preparing you to have your eyes open. Right? Because you know what hurts, what drains hope, what causes spiritual anxiety. I mean, you know, because you've experienced it. So you could sit back, well, how do I know? Well, look what your life has been like. And where has God moved in your life? Or perhaps right now, where do you wish He would move? And then look around you and see if there's folks having the same afflictions accomplished in their life, which 1 Peter 5 says that's what's going on. You need to know that your brothers in the world are suffering the same thing. So there are people all around you who are currently walking through the valley that you have walked, or maybe walking. And so connect the dots between them. Lift up your eyes and see, hey, there's a reason that God was using these circumstances in my life to prepare me so that I could be fit and sharpened as an instrument to help somebody else. Where does it fit together? Where are your brothers and sisters around you going through the same things that you've experienced? And there's the place to move. Right there. And have your eyes open for that. Consider that. Listen for that. Think about that. And in so doing, we actually apply the lessons learned and pass along the grace received that's come to us from God. So we need to really have our heart thinking that we're not just like a receptacle. God gave us comfort and we just sort of stick it in our comfort jar and hold it to ourselves. But that we're actually a conduit. God's comforted us, and therefore we are to pass along that comfort. Right? There's not supposed to be a stopgap thing there that causes it all to well up. It's actually supposed to be a channel into the lives of other people, because God's comfort of us can overflow into the comfort of other people. So connect the dots between your circumstances and your cares and concerns and the circumstances that you're seeing other people go through. And I'll say something about this in a moment, but I mean, don't necessarily conclude that if they're in the similar circumstance, they have to be feeling the same way that you do, right? But it's at least a place where you can be looking, right? When you know people are experiencing things that you've experienced, then there's a place to be watching. How can you provoke them to love and good works? How can you encourage them? Okay, I could spend hours and hours just detailing what all those might be, but the reality of it is you can do the inventory of your life, right? You know your life better than I know your life. Okay, so you could sit down and say, where have been the stress points in my life that I needed someone to come alongside of me and encourage me and help me? You can write the profile so that you're looking for where that is so that you can move toward it, right? And I think that's a simple way for us to improve how we see one another. Another, I think, fairly simple and obvious one that we just have to engage in is that, and this is going to sound sort of stupid, but it was in my head, all right? We need to employ a facial recognition system, all right? You ever watch crime shows? They're running people through and they identify them. But here's what I mean by that, okay? Proverbs 15:13, for instance, says, a joyful heart makes a cheerful face. That's the positive way. What would be the implied negative statement there? Okay? A joyful heart makes a cheerful face. Then a saddened heart produces some other kind of face, right? I mean, I think most of us recognize, in fact, we know it not just from human experience, but the record of human experience in the Bible, that a person's face often indicates some of the state of the heart. Remember Nehemiah working before the king? And Nehemiah is confronted. Why is your face sad when you are not sick? I mean, even a pagan king could look at the face of his servant and draw a conclusion about it that there's a look on that face that reflects some trouble in the heart. And that truth, that principle, should not be ignored by us. But it often is ignored by us. If we're probably honest, it's because we know that face indicates a deeper pool of problem, and we really don't feel like taking a step into that pool. We can see somebody whose face clearly reveals that there are hurts or issues that are happening there, and so what we see it and we think, oh boy, I don't know if I have time for this. I don't know if I know what to do with this. I don't know how to handle this. And so what happens is we just sort of, hey, how you doing? Gone. We're not actually seeing it as potentially the indication that God would want us to consider how we should move in to provoke that person to love and good works and give encouragement to. Okay? And as I said a few weeks ago, I recognize that there are some people who have perfected the art of communicating unhappiness. Right? But that doesn't mean we transpose that person's problem over to every other person, right? For the person who is perpetually in need of or trying to draw attention should not distract us from the person who genuinely needs it. Okay, and what I'd say is that's where you'd have to ask God to give you wisdom. You know, there's an old line in training people for to do counseling that says, you can't do counseling if you don't have a counselee. And the point is, there are some people who just want to talk to you. They don't really want to change. And so don't think you're doing counseling if all the person does is just want to talk. I mean, they just want to talk about their problems. So the reality of it is you know, you have to realize that just because some people are never going to change their sour disposition, it doesn't mean everybody else just needs to tough it out on their own. Right? So what you have to do is ask God to help you see what is the right response here and move toward. Okay, to move toward the need. And so we need to have eyes that see. You need to have eyes that see. And not everybody who's facially revealing a sadness necessarily wants you to spend hours with them. They may just want you to speak a word that brings joy. Something as simple as, hey, I know you're going through a tough path right now. I'm praying for you. If I can do anything else, let me know. I mean, but the reality is we sometimes want to see no problems because that makes it easier for us. And what we end up doing is not ministering as Christ has called us to. A third way I think we can improve our vision. Okay, the first is connect the dots between circumstances and concerns and cares. Second is look at the face. It reveals the heart. I think we need to consider asking deeper questions and listening carefully. You know, Proverbs 25 talks about, the thoughts of a man's heart are deep waters, but someone can draw it out of them. And I think here's, and again, I'm trying to make it as simplified as possible just to urge us to move forward. But, you know, perhaps instead of standard lines that we say when we see each other, how you doing? I mean, that basically, it asks for and usually gets no more than a couple words. Usually two letters. Okay. How you doing? Okay. Great. And what I mean by standard lines, so you know when somebody says that to you, that's their way of saying hi. Hey, how you doing? They're not really saying, let's grab a chair and sit down and you give me a 30-minute answer. They're saying, I know I have an obligation to express some cordiality and interest in you, and so I'm doing it, and you're going to do the cordial thing to me. Great. And if there's going to be more conversation, that line was just the opening, and there'll be more conversation. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm saying that's how you make it through life. You can't have a half-hour discussion with every person you see. So we find shorthand ways to just navigate our way through. But that shouldn't be all that we do. And it certainly shouldn't be at the center of life in the assembly of God's people if we know what the Scriptures are teaching that we read this morning, that we're looking at here. So maybe just finding some way to word it differently that says, hey, I really do want to know what's going on. So how are you holding up? It's a little bit different than the one that they'd be expected to hear. Hey, is there anything I can pray for you about that draws out possibly some answer? The reality of it is we need to be willing to slow down and engage in a way that draws out from people the fear that they need courage for, which is what encouragement is, right? Or they need some hope that something they're facing may seem hopeless, and they need someone to give hope to them. So that we need to draw out what that fear or that hopelessness may be. And that's a part of how we open up our eyes to it, is that we're trying to see what's going on that we need to lift and move toward. So we have to have our eyes open. I mean, that's the first step. Because if we do not see where people are discouraged, we cannot move to encourage. How's that for the profound thought of the morning, right? But the reality of it is, it's that simple truth that is confirmed most often by its neglect. We don't see, so we don't move to. You're in chapter 10. Let's go down a few verses and add the second word. Look at verses 32 through 34. But remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Look at that word in verse 34. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners. And if you recall the words I used see and sympathize. And the reason I go to this text is because it's a context of suffering, right? In verse 32, endured a great conflict of sufferings, and that sufferings is not just physical, because notice verse 33, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations. All right, so there was actually verbal attack against them, but the reality of it was it had the effect, the impact of causing them, I think what we saw in chapter 12, to be weakened hands and feeble knees. People who were walking a pathway and were staggering in that pathway. So it has a broader ramification than the specific application it has to the issue of them being prisoners or persecuted. Notice in verse 33 The end of the verse there says, partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. The word that's used there, translated sharers, is the word that we often get in the New Testament of fellowship. So you actually fellowshipped with them in this ill treatment that they're experiencing. You showed a solidarity with them, a oneness, a communion with them in it. So here's a scenario where you have people who are going through deep waters of difficulty, and another group of people who, rather than seeing that and moving away from it, actually move toward it. They identified with them in their suffering. They showed sympathy. That is, there was a joining of their feeling with them in it. Sometimes the word sympathy, or biblically the word compassion, the idea of they're experiencing some suffering, and the symphony part of it. Sim is we're going to join with them in it. We're going to share in it with them. We're going to carry it out. You know, sometimes you hear something and it just like lodges in your brain. I mean, 33 years ago or so, somewhere in the early 80s, a man who ended up becoming a friend, acquaintance, Pastor Jim Singleton, was preaching in a conference service while in college, and he defined compassion this way, and it just stuck. Your pain in my heart. I mean, that's really the issue. Compassion is your pain in my heart. I feel what you're feeling. I see what you're experiencing, and I see what you're feeling, but it's not now just a dispassionate thing. It's a compassionate thing, a sympathetic thing, that our heart moves toward them. Because not only must our eyes be open, our hearts must be open. And we must have the recognition of what they're experiencing in that regard. I mean, we seek to lift them up rather than just leave them alone, or to approach them with compassion rather than condemnation. And honestly, this is just practical Christ-likeness. I mean, we're in the book of Hebrews. Go back to chapter 2 and verse 18. When I say practical Christ-likeness, it is us doing what Jesus does. Okay, just so you can have a little bit of the context thought, look at verse 17. Therefore he, that's Jesus, had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. And keep that verse 18 thought in your mind. Jump over to chapter 4 real quickly. And look at beginning of verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So here's the reality of it, is that the writer of Hebrews has talked about the sympathy of Jesus Christ for us as sinners, and the reason he had that was because he himself suffered as an obedient follower of his Father. He walked through the valley of temptation, and so he has an inner understanding of what we are experiencing. And that makes him able to come to our aid. That gives us confidence to go to Him. All right, so let's just think about that. And obviously there's a massive gap between Jesus and us. But when we see brothers and sisters going through the adversities of life in a sin-cursed world, we too have experienced that and therefore should have a heart that is moved toward them in sympathy because they're experiencing something that we know and understand the difficulties of experience. And in fact, when we show such sympathy, it gives them encouragement to have us come to their aid. Right? That they know we're coming at them not from an angle of what's wrong with you, but hey, I know it's rough in this world. Okay? And so when we have the sympathy that Christ has, it not only moves us toward them, but it causes the person that needs the help to have some confidence that we are actually there to help, that we want to minister to them. Okay? And so we need to recognize that. So I think Hebrews gives us two important keys to this. Just for ease of turning, I'm going to start with the one I had second in my notes. I'm just going to reverse it. Look down to chapter 5, verse 2. Like you knew what was in my notes, so I guess I didn't need to tell you that. But there was a logic for why it was in my notes, all right? But here's the first one. 5:2. How do you cultivate sympathy? The first is to recognize our own weaknesses. Look at 5:2, talking about human priests, right? Verse 1 says, priest taken from among men. And then it talks about that priest. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. All right? So don't get lost on the ignorant and misguided part, all right? Recognize this. Here's our tendency to look at the person who needs help and think they're ignorant and misguided. But what this text is saying, the person who actually is able to come to help them is the person who recognizes their own weaknesses. Okay? Because if you think you're above all of this, you're really not going to be in much of a really good position to come along and help. Right? And in fact, in the context, it's drawing out the analogy between Jesus experiencing suffering and being able to come to our aid. All right? So here's the thing. You go, well, you know, how can I cultivate sympathy? You know what? You can humble yourself. It's the first step. Okay? And I had this second because I think that's probably the harder thing for us to accept, that my lack of sympathy is pride. All right? But I think what 5:2 is saying, that you don't think you're weak, you will not look at people who are weak well. Okay? So recognize that you're not all that. All right? You may not be falling where they're falling, or discouraged where they're discouraged, or struggling with what they're struggling with, but you certainly are not above struggle. You are beset with weaknesses. And so you should have compassion on people who struggle with weaknesses. I mean, that's the reality. Go to chapter 13, please, if you would. Look at chapter 13 and verse 3. Because there's two statements in here that open up the window into how we cultivate sympathy. Remember the prisoners, here comes the first one, as though in prison with them. And those who are ill-treated, here's the second, since you yourselves also are in the body. So the idea of remember the prisoners it's not a mental thing. I mean, remember most often in the scriptures is actually that you move toward, right? Remember, what it says in Exodus, that God remembered his people Israel. It wasn't like all of a sudden God said, oh yeah, I had some people called Israel. It's that he moved. He moved toward them. So when this text says, remember the prisoners, it's saying, move toward to minister to them, like chapter 10 talked about. But here's the reason why they should go try and take care of their needs. It's as if you were in prison with them. As in other words, think about what it would be like if it were you. Right? Put yourself in their position. Think about what it would be like to be a prisoner and what you would need if you were in prison, which is different in their day than ours. I mean, they were dependent on people outside of the prison to provide for their needs. So remember what it would be like if you were there, and then move accordingly. Or if you're facing people who are ill-treated, notice this one is sort of weird, right? Since you yourselves are also in the body. Okay, so you understand what it's like to hurt, to be ill-treated. So you know what that's like, so move toward people who are experiencing that. I mean, I think the problem for us often with the, you know, sort of cutting the nerve of our sympathy is we fail to identify with the experience of the person. I mean, we don't really think about what it would be like if that was our husband that died, or our wife that died, or our mom, or our dad, or our son, or what it would be like if it was our husband who left us, or our wife that left us, or we had lost the job, or we got diagnosed with the cancer, or we had, and just fill it all in. Because we don't actually put ourselves into what they're experiencing and think about it from the inside. We look at it very coolly, very indifferently. And so we move towards somebody whose heart might be breaking, and we you know, prescribe them a couple Bible verses and say, hey, you know, God's going to be true. And we walk up. Because we're not feeling what they're feeling. We're not even attempting to feel what they're feeling. And so we have to recognize that God calls us to treat one another as we would want to be treated. That's what Jesus said in Matthew 7:12, right? So we need to try to think about. A humble view of ourselves prepares us to be sympathetic with others. A realistic view of what it would be like to experience what somebody's experiencing. Now, let me get just three quick warnings about that, all right? Don't assume or act like you understand fully if you've never gone through it. Okay? So, I've not lost a parent. So, I don't fully understand what they're doing. I've not lost a child. I've not had certain diagnoses. I've not experienced certain things. So I cannot act as if I fully understand it. But I don't have to fully understand it. All I have to do is come alongside of it and recognize that this is a personal reality. Okay? And so I may not have had the exact experience that somebody has, and therefore I can't fully understand it, but that doesn't mean that I can't be moving toward it. Don't assume or act that they're just like you. Okay, and that's a tough part about it, because what we're not trying to say is, how would I act if I were in that situation? Okay, we're saying, how might I feel if I were in that situation? What might I be burdened about? What might I be struggling with? But it's all might, because you don't know for certain, And in fact, they're not like you completely, so it might be different. So don't transpose yourself to the other person. But try to move into their moccasins a little bit. And see it from inside. And certainly I would urge you not to make it about you. Because here's, I think, a classic kind of mistake is somebody's experienced something and somebody thinks, well, I want to sort of build a connection with them, and so they tell them about something that they experienced that they think is like what they're experiencing, and it's often not. You know? There's something in us that sometimes is careless about drawing comparisons to life-changing things. You just need to be careful that it doesn't become stories about all that you've experienced. That's, I guess, my point. You're moving to help somebody. They really don't need to hear about all of your problems. Or have you trivialized their problems by comparisons that might not really hit home? Right? So be careful. It's not about you. It's about them. And it's about trying to understand so that you can join in with them in the feeling of it. I mean, the reality of it is that if you have a real problem and you've got a spectrum, all right, between, if I could put it this way, the pain and problem kind of issue. I mean, if I go to the doctor, and this is the part about not being like everybody else. I mean, if I go to the doctor, I really am not. I'm not looking for a guy to just sort of like, put his arm around me. Say, "How you feeling, buddy?" I'm like, I got a problem. Fix it. That's I tend to be down on the problem side of the spectrum, right? But I've watched guys who can fix problems walk into a hospital room and not really be very helpful. I mean, they may know their stuff, but they walk into that room and they're acting like they got a slab of meat on the table instead of a person. And that's not a good move either. I mean, I want the doctor to know what he's doing and care about solving the problem, not just feel my pain, but I also want him to recognize that this is not a corpse. This is a person. Okay, so what I'm saying to you is that's the spectrum you and I have to work with, right? We have to realize that we're encountering people who really are hurting, and we need to recognize and sympathize with that. But, and the third and fourth steps is we have to try and help them with the problem too. And that's the part that here's what I'd say is you just got to depend on the Spirit of God to help you know what's the balance at that point. That's why we need to be walking in the Spirit. We need to be yielded to Him so that we know, hey, does this person really just need me to sort of sit down with them and show them that I'm here and I care? Or is there something that I need to do to help them? But I really won't move in either direction until I have some appreciation for what they're going through. That I actually have some sympathy toward it. So we need to gauge it carefully. And we need to temper our response and our application in light of your gifts. Mercy people tend to go down toward the pain side of the spectrum. Right? Exhorters tend to be up here on the problem side. And so you need to recognize, as I said early in the series, that if all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. And you need to realize that's not the way God made the church, as we read this morning. It's not all eyes, it's not all ears, it's not all hands, it's not all feet. We need to have a diversity so that in the diversity of the gifts, God accomplishes His purpose. I mean, we need to recognize that genuine love for God always shows up in love for His family. I mean, there's just no denying that biblically. mean, if we don't love his family, we don't love him. 1 John pounds that home to us. Right? Love for God will produce love for those who are born of God, and that means it will deeply affect our eyes and our heart. We will see and we will sympathize. We will pay attention and we will be affected by what we see. If our eyes are never open to our spiritual family, then there is a serious, serious problem in us. And if our heart is never affected by the things that we see, there is a serious, serious problem. I mean, and we have to start right there, because if it doesn't change the mindset and motivation of our life to recognize that our Father gave birth to us as one of his children, and our love for our spiritual brothers and sisters is only as real as its expression. Okay, because we can't love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth, John says. So the biblical balance in the Church of Jesus Christ is that we rejoice and weep, and we suffer and we rejoice. And I think sometimes this is the part that I mean, we have to think about it as both of them, right? I mean, if we're to rejoice with those who rejoice, that's just as true as if we're to weep with those who weep. So a church that is all rejoicing, no weeping, is a church that's out of balance. And so is a church that's all weeping and no rejoicing. But what happens is, because there's an imbalance in one direction, sometimes people can push the imbalance in the other. And it's supposed to be both. We suffer, we rejoice, we weep, we rejoice. Because not everybody's at the same stage. All right? I mean, this morning, in this group, there are people rejoicing. And there are people suffering. And God calls us to do each of them with whomever is in whatever state. So are our eyes open? Are our eyes open so that you can see who's rejoicing and who's weeping? Are our hearts open so that we can rejoice with them? We're glad about their gladness, and we're sad about their sadness. And friend, if you're one of those who are suffering or weeping, are you moving toward help or away from it? I mean, are you ready to recognize that a part of God's answer for you is the openness that would share your weeping and share your suffering so that others can suffer with you and weep with you? I mean, it's supposed to all be the part of the body that God's called us to. Let's bow together, please, and pray. Father, thank you for the mercy that you continually distribute through your people. The grace that's imparted through the love that comes from you through someone to us. And Lord, even as Paul said to the Thessalonian believers that they abound in it, he wanted them to excel still more. And I take that, Lord, to mean that there's none of us in this room who cannot grow in our capacity to see and sympathize more effectively with those around us. That until we reach the perfection of Christ, there's room to grow. So help us to be honest about the state of our eyes and our heart. Help us to be humble, to acknowledge our weaknesses, so we can have sympathy on those who also struggle with weakness. Help us to think about what it would be like to be walking through some of the difficult valleys that we see around us, so that our heart shares the burden, carries the weight, comes alongside of and demonstrates real sympathy. Lord, you know the hearts that are aching here this morning. Some who've been aching for months or years, carrying some heavy weight. Some who are going through an intense time of trial. Lord, help us be what we ought to be. Make us a body that really functions with the kind of unity that we carry those burdens. We care about those who are so burdened. And this is all because of Christ our Savior, who walked in our shoes, yet without sin. Understood what it was like to be tired, to be without necessary items, to be despised and rejected, betrayed, lied about, who understood all of these things, yet remained faithful to you for the joy that was set before him. And Lord, make that true in our hearts, because we believe in Christ. We bank on him and his promise of life. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.